all of us would like to be able to look ahead a little bit and anticipate what tomorrow might bring, or the next day, or next week, or next month, or even next year, or if we could, to even figure out what's going to happen to us or to our families within the next 10 years. I would like to have a crystal ball. That's what everyone says. Well, if you had a crystal ball, we could figure out, you know, we look into it, we say something or ask for something, and we could figure out what's going to happen in the weeks and the months and the years ahead. Well, we don't have a crystal ball, but there are certain things we do know, and I'm not talking about prophecy, but certain things that we can count on that are going to happen in our lives. Some of the things that are going to happen are thinkable. Some are unthinkable. Now, here in the East Texas area, there's an advertisement that comes on radio. It's an insurance firm. I don't know if you've heard this advertisement or not, but they go on by talking about the thinkable versus the unthinkable, and the unthinkable being something none of us wants to have happen, that is to be involved in an automobile accident, and perhaps you would lose your life, or you would be maimed, or you would be hurt for life. That is unthinkable. None of us want things like that to occur. So we have the thinkable, and we have the unthinkable. And we sort of just walk through life, many of us, and we don't consider what it is that might happen to us, and if it does happen to us, what we're going to do if it does. Now, I'd like to give you some illustrations, because some of these, I'm going to tell you, are going to happen to you, whether you know it or not. You may not want them to, but some of these things are going to happen. I want to be a little bit optimistic about some of these things, if I may go back and rehearse some of the things that many of us would have thought years and years and years ago when we were developing our families, when we were considering our mates, things that were thinkable versus things that were unthinkable. And here we are years later, some of us having already endured things that are unthinkable. I recall a long, long time ago when a dream of mine, it was thinkable, was to find the right person, the person of my dreams, and to get married and to begin a family and to have a newborn son. That's thinkable, isn't it? The unthinkable is you find the person of your dreams and you begin your family by having triplets. Now, that's not bad, is it? I guess if you're the wife, it might be. But what I'm trying to say is you sort of get prepared for one, but not necessarily the other. Most of us would find it very difficult to cope with triplets. Recently, I heard of this on the news. It was aired on Paul Harvey as well as in USA Today newspaper. Did all of you hear about this lady who did what I thought was thinkable? She was on a game show, and she won an automobile. She won it. I don't know how she did it. She said the right word or guessed the words on Vanna White's program. Whatever it is she did, she won an automobile, but the unthinkable occurred for her. The car she won was a foreign car, and she turned it down. She refused to accept a foreign-made, a Japanese or Korean or Yugoslavian-made vehicle. I don't know what make it was. And everyone was a little bit startled, and so they had to work the program over a little bit and cut that portion out of her turning down the automobile. And I think that they settled with a $1,000 cash gift to her. I don't know what the United Auto Workers did. You see, that was her explanation. The reason why she turned it down is she had worked for the United Auto Workers all her life, and she was not going to accept a car of a foreign make because of loyalty to the UAW. What I was wondering about is I wonder if the UAW was loyal to her. They gave her a pickup? All right. I'm glad to hear that. I didn't know that. So she got two vehicles. Well, good. That restored my confidence just a little bit. Just a little bit. So they gave her a Chrysler and a pickup. Well, I'll tell you what, she's in for a lot of problems. All right, let's... Maybe not. We'll see. But that was nice. But it struck me a little bit curious. The thinkable was none of us would turn out a vehicle, but she did. Now, what about some things that might be just a little bit more serious? The thinkable. You raise your family. Here you are, maybe in your 40s, and you're working diligently towards your retirement. The unthinkable. Well, here you are, raising your family. They're just about grown. You get your last child off to college, and then you learn all of a sudden that you are unexpectedly pregnant. That would tend to change your life, wouldn't it? Somebody would be mad at somebody. How about this? This happens all the time. The thinkable. You invite your children to come and see you for a while. They show up and announce that they're moving in. One's thinkable, the other one is not quite as thinkable. This one. And this past week, the reason why this came to mind is we had two prayer requests about this. The thinkable is, as a young man, or perhaps a young lady, you're going to enlist in the armed services for the experience and the benefits. The unthinkable, you do enlist, and you are sent to Saudi Arabia in preparation for a war against Iraq and Saddam Hussein. The unthinkable. Last week, there were two prayer requests that came to our office asking for us to pray for their young sons who are now over there. The unthinkable. Some other ones that are unthinkable, I don't like this one. I know you wouldn't either. It's unthinkable to get audited by the IRS. None of us want that to happen. Another item is, what if you were to lose your home to a fire? You come home tonight. I hope you don't. I hope you don't ever have this happen to you. But you go home, and lo and behold, your home is burnt down to the ashes, and all your pictures and all your valuables and all your clothes and all your furniture. Aside from the insurance, all right, let's say it's insured. Just the memories alone that would have gone up in flame. It's unthinkable. One other item, then, I thought I would mention, because all these things can happen to us, you see. Here it is, the thinkable. You've gone through life, you've raised your family, you've built a little bit of a financial base, everything's all set. And so you and your husband are making plans to take some time off together, to travel around, to go to various places, various parks, various areas of the country, and enjoy your time together. And then you learn that your husband has Alzheimer's disease. And he doesn't, in a very few short weeks, even remember your name. That's going to change your life forever, isn't it? These things happen. Some of them are exciting, others of them are not exciting at all. One of the things that could change your life would be something we'd all like to do, is I would like to win the lottery. And it would change my life. It really would. I'd have a lot more friends than I had ever thought I had. It would change my life. I don't know that I would buy a different car, necessarily move anywhere, but one thing that would happen is I would have a lot of friends that I didn't have before I won the lottery, because that seems to be the way life is. These few things that I've mentioned, and of course I could go on and on and on and on to mention any number of events to you. These are things that have been called in the 80s here and into the 90s, what are called life accidents. Here you and I are going along in life, making plans, maybe financially, physically, or with our family, socially, and the unexpected happens to us. And some people make their way through these events successfully, and others do not. The other day I was taught a little lesson. Actually, it's just a reminder of the lesson that I've been taught many times by a young lady. It's a teenage young lady. And I was discussing with her our youth program, because it was an awfully good program. All the young people were there together, and they're laughing together and crying together and hugging each other and all the wonderful things that took place there. And the young lady I was talking to was in a wheelchair. And we were seated at a long table. And I didn't think there was any reason not to discuss the youth program, because I learned a long time ago that young people or elderly people, whoever, who are in wheelchairs, they like to be treated just like normal people. So I thought, well, I would have been talking about this anyway. I'm going to go ahead and mention it. So I was talking about the youth program and the dancing and so forth and so on that all the kids were involved in. And she was right next to me, and I said, well, you know, one of these days maybe you'll be able to come down to the youth camp. And she looked at me and she said, her eyes lit up, and there was a real look of anticipation and excitement in her eyes. And she looked at me and she said, you know, I think maybe one of these days I will come. And I said, well, I hope you do. And she said something like, well, don't look for me on the dance floor, but the boys had better watch out. And I thought, boy, that's pretty nice. Here's a young lady who has every reason in the world to be terribly depressed and discouraged, because for all intents and purposes, unless God intervenes, she is never going to get out of that wheelchair. She will never dance one dance. She will never get behind a ski boat and ski in the water. And for all intents and purposes, unless something else really has worked out, she will never cast a fishing hook into the water to catch a fish, unless just some special situation has worked out. But she wasn't discouraged. And you know, she wasn't discouraged. I wasn't discouraged. She uplifted my spirit, as people like that tend to do. Life's accidents. I don't know that I have been through nearly as much as all of you have. I've had a couple of things happen to me that have prompted this sermon today. Not recently, these are things that have gone by, but I know that things like this might happen in the future, some of the things that I've mentioned to you here. Have any of you ever thought you were going to die? For sure? You really thought you were going to die? Well, I have to confess, there was one time in my life I really thought I was going to die. And the sermon that I'm giving is what I practiced at that time. This was a long time ago. I really thought I was going to die, and I recall how I felt. I even recall where I was, because it was something I had a lot of time to think about. I'll tell you where I was. It was about 8 or 9 years ago, back in Salt Lake City, Utah, and I was a minister of the Worldwide Church of God at the time, and I had always been very, very healthy. I mean, just very seldom sick. An occasional cold, but nothing ever serious, a little flu maybe, but nothing serious at all. Very, very little serious pain. Then all of a sudden, I started having some serious health problems. And do you think I told anybody? No. Do you think I went to the doctor? No. I just suffered. And it got worse, and then it'd get a little bit better, and I'd say, well, I'm getting better. And then it would get worse. And I began to talk to God seriously. I began to talk to him earnestly, because I felt and practiced the belief of healing, and I felt God could heal me. And I remember that I had come to the conclusion that it was all over for me. That I was, how old then? I must have been in my early 30s. I had one daughter to my name. At the time I was married. Everything was going my way, and then all of a sudden I was stricken with this life-ending illness. So I recall that what I did is I got in the vehicle, in my car, and I decided to take a long trip. It was a trip with purpose. Part of the purpose was to visit someone. Part of the purpose was to talk to God, because it was time to make up to the Lord whatever I had to do. So I got in the car, and I got out on those long freeways between Salt Lake City and Boise, Idaho, and I began to talk to God. And I remember I thought for sure it was all over. I can laugh about it a little bit now, but at the time it was very serious. And I sat there and I looked at that big moon that was up there, and I looked at the landscape, the mountains over there, the plains, the terrain, the small cities, country that I loved. I liked to be in it. I liked to hunt it and hike in it. I just couldn't believe that I was going to die. I just thought God couldn't let me die. So I talked to him quite earnestly. Have you ever cried buckets of tears that you didn't know you had enough tears? I mean, you just didn't know you had that many tears in you? I cried quite a few. Felt embarrassed about it. I thought, if anybody drives by and they see me, they're going to think I need, you know, put him in a white jacket and take him back home somewhere. But I drove on up there, and I visited with the people that I had to see. Do you think I talked to them about it? No. All personal. I drove back, and I had even a longer talk with God about it. And so I came back home, and about the time I got back to Salt Lake City, the thought crossed my mind, maybe it wouldn't be too wrong to go to a doctor just to see. Just to have myself checked. So I was a little bit relieved with that. And so I made a doctor's appointment, and I went to see the doctor, and he examined me, and he said, you're going to make it. I thought, well, good, that's good news. And he told me very simply that I just had a problem with a little medication. If I would take this medication regularly, that the problem would go away. And he was totally right. And to this day, I've had no problem at all recurring like that, and I don't want to ever have that problem again. But I was motivated by a number of concerns. I was motivated by the teachings of the church. The teachings of the church at that time frowned a little bit about us going to doctors, and I didn't want to go to a doctor for that reason. And then I just decided that there'd be nothing wrong with it, so I did. Talking to God helped a great deal. A great deal. Now, he didn't appear on the front of my car and tell me to go to a doctor. As a matter of fact, he didn't appear in my back seat, front seat. I didn't see him at all. But I thought he was listening, even though I was riding along in the car. Because there were other times, too, where I'd spent time on my knees, and I knew that God didn't necessarily mean that I couldn't talk to him in the car. You know what I'm saying? There are any number of events that I'm going to face in my life, and I know you will, too, where you can apply what I have to give to you in the time that remains today to help you through some of those unthinkable times that we're going to face. And what I'm going to tell you is not necessarily going to be comforting. but it will help a little bit. Because pain is pain, suffering is suffering, anxiety is anxiety. Staying up all night long worried about something is doing just that. You don't sleep. It affects your appetite. It affects what you think about. I'm not going to give you a solution to do away with all those physical symptoms. But perhaps there's a little bit of comfort that comes from knowing that God knows you, He knows me, He knows our children, He knows your families, and He knows a whole lot more about what's happening to you than perhaps you suspect. The example I want to focus in on today at length is the example of one of my favorites in the Scripture, the example of Joseph. You're all quite familiar with the example of Joseph and all that happened to him. There are some aspects of the story that's told to us in Scripture that I would like to share with you today. So let's turn back to Genesis chapter 37. And as you're turning back there, I'd like for you to think about a couple of things. When you have the unexpected happen to you, how do you respond? What do you do? Because there are any number of ways that we can respond. A lot of surveys have been performed about this subject, a lot of studies. People have contributed information in counseling, as well as just filling out forms and documents. I'd like to give you some results as you turn over to Genesis chapter 37. How do you think it is that most people make it through life's most difficult moments, or what's been called in the 80s and 90s, life's accidents? Let me tell you, there are four things that research has demonstrated. First of all, people who are going through a crisis, and let's name some of the other ones, like divorce, like losing a child up in years or maybe before it's ever born, your husband losing his work and not having any opportunity for work in the future, your children coming home and informing you that they have a drug problem, or perhaps that they're pregnant, any number of problems that we can look at. So I feel, and I can say this safely, that all of us in this room will face some of life's unexpected moments in the times ahead, for weeks and months. And you don't have a crystal ball to look into, and neither do I. But I do have something to help once I face one of those little problems or major problems. What are the four things that people do to make it through some of these life's accidents? And I want you to think about yourself as I discuss these with you. The first thing they do to get through it, of the four, is they tend to work more. I don't mean be a workaholic, but they throw their energies and their efforts and their minds into their work. It gives them something to do. They don't give up. They don't just go home and sit and do nothing, close a room, pull down the shades, lock the doors, and do nothing. No, they get back into the routine of life. They get back into working, into the habit. And of course, when you're working, it depends upon your job, naturally, that you are put in contact with friends and associates and people who know you and can help you. And that's the second thing that they did, they find in this survey, is people who get through these incidents, they depend on their friends. Any number, the men and women, old and young, boss, fellow employees. Another thing they do is they see the purpose and the reason for whatever is happening to them. They may not understand it, but they tend to see purpose in it, that they can get through it and get out on the other side of it and be a better person. Now, I brought with me a letter that was written in this past week, and as it was read to me, I had to think about the marvelous attitude that these people have, because in spite of all the problems that I'm going to read to you, they seem to be all right. Now, let me just share this letter with you, and I'm not going to tell you who they are or where they're from, because it's quite personal. It just says, thank you all very much for what you're doing. These two people are quite elderly. They are well above 70 years of age. The person who's writing, I believe, is the female. She says, I don't walk, nor do I rest well at night. So much pain, deep vein problems, extra high blood pressure, congestive heart failure. She says, I have no cartilage in my knees, bone on bone. And later on she tells you why, because she's quite heavy. And I guess all the extra weight she's carrying has just worn away the cartilage in her knees. She says that she has to use a wheelchair because of arthritis in the arm and the shoulder. She goes on to say that she and her husband have been married for well over 50 years together. She says she needs a hospital bed. She cannot get up from the basement to the kitchen. She has had to, in times gone by, literally crawl from the basement to the kitchen because of the extra weight that she carries and the health problems. She says, "My dear husband brings my meals and he even fixes them. There are just 12 steps up from the basement to the kitchen. The doctor says it would be helpful if he had some kind of electric means to help me in preparing the meals and the food and take care of the responsibilities. Her husband has had 1.5 tons of cloth to recently fall on him. And as a result of that, he now has 8 pins in the silver plate in his hip and his leg. He has had 2 heart attacks. He has had part of his intestines and 2 growths removed, and he's also had a stroke." This is pretty discouraging, don't you think? I mean, if you've got a reason to sort of give up and sit back and do nothing, this is part of it. Goes on to tell us that they have all sorts of assistance available to them through the Medicare and other supplementary means. She says this, "Because of Christ, we are so happy. Really happy." Goes on to say, "Each of us have had both of our eyes operated on for cataracts, and we had it done by means of a laser. She encourages us to go on and to complete the work that we're doing because," as she says here once again, "we are very happy with our lives." I read that and I thought, that is absolutely amazing to me. Here are some people who have been able to, in spite of all these physical circumstances, see a purpose and a reason in life. That was the third thing that people do. The fourth thing they do is they pray a lot. Pray a lot. They talk to God a lot. Now, the opposite side of this is, let me tell you what people do who don't cope well. Rather than work more, here's what they do. They drink more, they eat more, or they take drugs. Rather than depend upon their friends, what they do is they pretend the problem doesn't exist. Recently, I was told of a situation involving a young couple. Just in a way, you'd like to get a hold of people and strangle them for doing this because there are families and children involved. It was a young couple where one of the children has run off and left the other mate with the small children involved and just gone off and done their thing as if the problem doesn't exist. And yet it really does. Rather than seeing purpose and reason in the situation, what people do, they will then develop physical symptoms. High blood pressure, stress, they'll get sick, they don't sleep at night, they turn to drink, physical symptoms. And rather than praying, what people will do is they will escape into fantasy, not realizing the seriousness of the problem. Now there's a verse, as we turn back here to Genesis chapter 37, that I want to repeat to you several times today. The verse goes like this, "For it is God which works in you both to will and to do of his good pleasure." Do you believe that verse? Paul wrote it to the Philippian church over in chapter 2 and verse 13. Philippians 2 and verse 13. "It is God which works in you both to will and to do of his good purpose," or his good pleasure. Does that mean that God knew that I was riding along in an automobile talking to him and unrealistically thinking that I was going to die? Yeah, sure did. Does God know about these two people who have been married well over 50 years and have a terrible state of life apparently to live in? Sure does. Maybe their life isn't as bad as we might suspect, but it seems to be pretty difficult. Do you think that God knows about this young couple who recently split up and she went one way and her husband went the other way and the little kids involved? Yes, God knows about all of that. But God's not orchestrating it. I really don't believe that, because God doesn't believe in pain and suffering and divorce. He really doesn't. But it is God which works in us both to will and to do of his good pleasure. And so for encouragement, I want us to take quickly a look at Genesis chapter 37. There are a lot of verses here that we could examine at length. And in reading through the story of Joseph, I feel sympathy, I feel compassion, I don't feel anger necessarily. But in reading his story and seeing what happens to him, it helps me understand what's going to happen to me. And when it happens, what I'm supposed to do. Oh, I can get angry, I can get mad, I can get upset, I can throw things around, I can give up, I can take my car and run it over a cliff. No, I can, but that's not what God wants me to do. I can turn to drugs, I can turn to alcohol, I can turn to physical abuse, but that's not in here. And his life is a lot worse than mine has been. You know the story. There are a couple points I'd like for you to notice. How old was he when this story starts? He is 17 years old. Now, I'd like to just make a little point here. You talk to people sometimes, and they'll say, well, I know when God started working with me. And you'll say, oh, really? And they'll say, well, yes, and I can remember the exact moment God started working with me. Well, I guess we can all say that, but it might be difficult to prove because, you see, Joseph is 17 years old here, and he doesn't know why this happened to him for 22 years. It takes 22 years before Joseph understands why he ends up in the pit. You know what I'm saying? And I don't think Joseph was looking forward to it. I don't think he anticipated pit time. Oh boy, I want to get thrown in the pit. This is all part of God's purpose. I can't wait. I hope there's not a whole lot of water in it. And I hope the bugs don't bite. It's all part of... No, he didn't do that. As a matter of fact, his brothers tell us later on in the story, because they sort of begin to piece it together, they realize that to the state that Joseph cried out to them and they didn't hear, and they think then that God's going to punish them through Joseph later on, which he didn't. He just delivered them from famine. So he's 17 years old here. I'm not sure how much wisdom Joseph had because he keeps telling his brothers these dreams he has. And his brothers hated him. The Bible says clearly. So it tells me that sometimes when you're 17 years of age, you don't have wisdom yet. Some 17-year-olds are more wise than others, but this particular one, the example we have here, he might have been better off not to have, how the young kids say it today, nah, nah, nah at each other. I know something that you don't know. And told them twice the story. If you'll notice something I find curious, though, in chapter 37, verse 11, after Joseph told his father the second dream, it says that his father observed the same. And this was the dream about the sun and the moon and the stars. The 11 stars and the sun and the moon. And then 22 years later, guess what's going to happen? All of his brothers and his father, his family are all gathered around him when he is right there at Pharaoh's hand. We're going to have to hurry along quickly. Verse 18, a question I'd like you to ponder if you're studying it, is whose idea was it in the first place to kill him? Because it says here they conspired against him to slay him. The Bible doesn't say, does it? It says they conspired against him to slay him. And verse 19 says, and they said one to another, behold, this dreamer comes. And now we find Reuben intervening, first of all, on behalf of Joseph in verse 21. And then in verse 23, we find that it comes to pass here that they strip Joseph of his coat and they're going to cast him into the pit. Verse 26, Judah then asks the question, why should we slay him? Why don't we sell him? And they do go ahead and sell him. It says so in verse 27 as they come to that. Let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and let not our hand be upon him. Now, the point I'm trying to make here, was God with Joseph at this point, do you think? Yes, he was. Definitely he was with Joseph. But where was Joseph? He was in the pit. Now, that sometimes there's a little irony here because we think that if God's with us, you don't ever end up in the pit. You don't ever end up with a problem like alcohol. You don't ever end up with a problem of a child, an unwanted pregnancy, your daughter, for example, coming home. You know, things like that don't happen to people that you're working with, do they? Yes, they do. You literally do end up in the pit, and God is very much aware of it. Now, oftentimes, those are just a result of our own sins and transgressions. Here we find out that Joseph was there not really knowing why he was there, but later on would know. We're going to skip through a few verses here, but one thing I want you to see, finally in verse 36, he is sold or taken into Egypt unto Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. Let's skip an entire chapter, and here we come to chapter 39. Joseph is in Egypt. What is Joseph doing, brethren? Is he a CEO? Is he a millionaire? Does he have a plush home on a golf resort somewhere? No, he doesn't. For all intents and purposes, he is a slave. That's what he's doing, and yet God is still with him, and he is a slave. A terrible thing occurs here because he has to make sure that he doesn't disobey God's laws, which he doesn't. He doesn't disobey God's laws. He is almost seduced, or the wife of the master of the house tries to seduce him. He doesn't allow that, and that's one of the things I want to expand upon, if I may just take a moment. There are three things that I'd like to encourage all of you to do anytime you're facing a major problem in life, a crisis, something unexpected, something even good, and that is the following three things.
First of all, you take whatever order you want. First of all, talk to God about it. Just take time to talk to God. I mean serious talk about it. If it's a big enough problem to you to occupy your time, talk to God about it. You know, if you think you're going to die, you better talk to the one who can give you life. Secondly, is obey God's laws. Make sure. Examine your life carefully. Make sure you are obeying God's laws, all 10 of them. If you are having marital problems, for example, make sure you are not committing adultery. Does that make sense? It surely does. If you are suffering from all sorts of health problems, and I hope you're not, but if you are, make sure you're obeying God's laws, all 10 of them. Now, we were having a discussion the other day about a situation, and the situation involved an individual that is not unlike many other individuals, and basically speaking, this person's life is involved in alcohol. That's what his life is involved in, alcohol. And he doesn't understand why it is he's as unhappy as he is. Well, he can talk to God, and he ought to talk to God, and he can go to his friends, and yes, they better do that, but what he better do is he better stop getting drunk. Don't you all agree? It's so frustrating sometimes when you talk to people and they want ministers or counsel or booklets or the Bible to say, listen, let's just wave this over your head, let's look into the crystal ball, and it's all over. It's not all over. Quit getting drunk. Do that first. Let's get in step with God's laws, all 10 of them. I was wondering, do we ever get caught for doing something we're not guilty of? Yes, we do. Joseph did. But in my life, most of the times I found out that I'm being hurt or experiencing pain, or I get caught because, you know what? I did do something wrong. I really did. I get sick because I don't eat right. I get stopped by policemen in my car because I really was speeding. And I know my excuse. I wasn't going as fast as everybody else. They were going, no, but I was speeding. I use that as an illustration because so often it's so easy to say, well, I wasn't doing anything. Well, oftentimes we are. The third thing after you make sure you're obeying God's laws is to use the resources that are available to you. And that means your church, your minister. If you're having marriage problems, you know who you ought to go see? You ought to go see a marriage counselor. If you're having financial problems, you know who you ought to go see? A financial counselor. Go to the resources that are available to you. You do these things, they'll help just a little bit. Let's hurry along here quickly with the story of Joseph. All sorts of phenomenal things happen with Joseph, not the least of which is over in chapter 40. He is placed in the prison. And here he is, God's working with him, and so he's in the pit one moment, he's a slave the next moment, and in the next moment, he's in prison. You mean to tell me that servants of God can end up in jail? Yeah, they really can. And you got to sit there, and I've got a hunch he probably did a lot of talking to God. And yet God allowed him to stay in prison. I'm not sure how long he allowed him to stay there, but I do know this. The Bible tells us that he was 17 when he started having those dreams. He would be 30 years of age, 13 years later, before he was before Pharaoh and given charge of all that Pharaoh had for him to take care of. That's 13 years. Now we find this event here in chapter 40 involving the butler and the baker. A fantastic story. A lot of human nature involved in this, the dreaming of dreams, the interpretation of those dreams. You notice what we find in verse 14 of chapter 40, where Joseph then has interpreted the dream of the butler. And I don't know what the butler and the baker did wrong to Pharaoh, but whatever it was pretty bad because they were sent into prison. Here they are having dreams. Joseph says, listen, think on me when it shall be well with you, and show kindness, I pray you, unto me, and make mention of me unto Pharaoh, and bring me out of this house. You think that was unreasonable? You think that was an unreasonable request of Joseph to the butler? Say, listen, I've interpreted your dream. I don't like jail either. When you get out of here, and it all comes true, will you remember me before Pharaoh? Because you might get me out too. Well, you know what? The butler didn't remember. As a matter of fact, he didn't remember for 2 years. 2 years! Now, I don't think it was a matter being that the butler never thought of Joseph's name. He just didn't choose to act on the knowledge that he had. And it wasn't, in my opinion, until it became to his advantage to remember that Joseph was still in jail, in prison, that he told Pharaoh about it. Well, verse 1 of chapter 41 tells us that at the end of 2 full years, Pharaoh dreamed a dream, and now Joseph is allowed to interpret that dream. He is also then placed in charge of all that Pharaoh has. He is also then 30 years of age at this point. It says so in verse 46 of chapter 41. Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. So that was 17 years when he started having the dream. 13 years later, here he is, finally delivered and given all this responsibility. So he was in the pit, he was a slave, and he was a prisoner. And now he finally is given this major responsibility. An intriguing story takes place in the intervening chapters, chapters 42 and 43, involving the famine. Here we come to chapter 45, and I'd like you to see something here. Here it is, if I figured and calculated correctly, about 22 years later. And I'll tell you who I feel sorry for in this story. I feel sorry for Israel. I feel sorry for Jacob, because he was heartbroken for 22 years over his son. And it was so needless, so useless, because any of the brothers could have told the truth at any moment, couldn't they? If they had just come back and told the truth, Jacob could have stopped worrying. They chose not to. I thought about all the nights around the dinner table, all the times together in the pasture when Jacob mourned the loss of his beloved son, and Reuben and Judah and all the other brothers kept their mouths shut, and he suffered. Well, here we come to many, many years later, because what we've had to start at, he was age 17. He's before Pharaoh at age 30. Remember, there was going to be 7 years of plenty, then 7 years of famine, right? Well, here we find in chapter 45, it's in the second year of the famine. That means an additional 9 years, so add that all on to the 13. It's 22 years later, we find Joseph unable to contain himself, and he reveals himself to his brothers in chapter 45 and verse 3. His brethren could not answer him, for they were troubled at his presence. They were probably scared half to death. They didn't know what was going on with this prince, this power, this man among men. And now Joseph says in verse 5, God did send me before you to preserve life. We finally get that statement. Years and years and years later, we see no bitterness here. We see no malice. We see no finger pointing at all. Verse 8, so now it was not you that sent me here, but God. And of course, I can see Judah and Reuben, who were all there at the pit. And old Judah, typical of how people would be today, who know they're in trouble, they say, well, you know, I sort of had that idea back then. But when we cast you in the pit, I knew it was going to work out that way, way back. No, they did not. They were scared to death, worried about what was going to happen to them here. Well, Joseph is so gracious and so loving toward his father as you get to the end of the story. And we find in chapter 45, verse 25, and they went up out of Egypt, and they came into the land of Canaan unto Jacob their father, and told him, saying, finally they told the truth. They said, Joseph is yet alive, and he is governor over all the land of Egypt. And Jacob's heart fainted, for he believed them not. And I love watching chapter 46 and verse 1, because Jacob was a man who really did love God, and God reassures him a little bit after all these years. Notice what it says here. Israel took his journey with all that he had, and he came to Beersheba, and offered sacrifices unto the God of his father Isaac. And there it is that God finally, after all these years, he spoke to Israel in the visions of the night, and he said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here I am, here am I. And he said, I am God, the God of your father. Fear not to go down into Egypt, for I will there make of you a great nation, and I will go down with you into Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again, and Joseph shall put his hand upon your eyes. So God reassured him personally after all those many, many years. How needless that suffering was, all those anxious moments, all the suffering. As even Jacob said, the gray hairs that would acquire come to his head over the loss of his son. What does this have to do with you and me? Well, first of all, when I read the example of Joseph, it shows me that oftentimes when something happens, I really don't know why it's happening. I really don't. And it may or may not be right of me to say God is in it or behind it. I can always be safe in saying that he is aware of it, because it is God which works in me both to will and to do of his good pleasure. God does not deliver me out of the pit necessarily right away. He does not deliver me out of slavery right away. He does not deliver me out of prison right away. Yet sometimes it may take a long, long time. In this case, if I've got it calculated correctly, 22 years. That means he was 39 years of age when it finally all fell together for him. That's a lot of time. And I'm sure there was a lot of happy moments after all of that. There was also probably some pretty serious talks. You know, real serious talks, especially with Jacob, about why his sons did it. Let me ask you to turn over finally now to Psalm 92. In Psalm 92, we find some encouragement to all of us. We find encouragement to those of us who know not what tomorrow will bring, who know not what this evening will bring, who know not what 1 month, 1 year, 5 years, 10 years from now will bring. We have no idea. I do know this, and I think I can say this safely, every one of us in this room will face some kind of an incident of major proportions in the very near future, because that's the way life is. The loss of a loved one. You learn of an illness. Something tragic happens. Maybe something wonderful happens, but it has its own penalties, even though it may be very wonderful, as we talked about winning the lottery. Well, God is aware of you and me, and he knows us. It is he that works in us both to will and to do of his good pleasure. I want you to see a short analogy that's given here in the book of Psalms, Psalm 92. The story is told about grass and a palm tree. And, of course, there's a major difference between the two of those. Psalm 92, beginning in verse 6. A brutish man knows not, neither does a fool understand this. And here's what happens. An analogy is drawn between the wicked who do what? They spring as grass. Because that's where a lot of contrasts come. The evil seem to prosper. They're never affected, and yet they are oftentimes. But we look at them and say, why do all these things happen to us and not them? Why does the rain fall on the evil? We're the righteous of God. The Bible says, when the wicked spring as the grass, and when all the workers of iniquity do flourish, it is that they shall be destroyed forever. Now verse 8 says, but you, Lord, are most high forevermore. Now notice in verse 12. The righteous, however, shall flourish like a what? Like a palm tree, and he shall grow like a cedar in Lebanon. It also goes on to say in verse 13, those that be planted in the house of the Eternal shall flourish in the courts of our God. They shall still bring forth fruit in old age. They shall be fat and flourishing. You know what that's telling us? It's a little story. In the spring of this year, if any of you planted fresh grass, you took those small seeds out there and you cast them into the ground, and you watch the sun warm the earth, and you probably watered a little bit, and I mean very quickly. Very quickly, the grass just sprung up. There it was. Well, I grant it was very thin, very fine, but it sprouted up very quickly. Now, if you go and take another plot of grass or ground, and you put a palm tree seed in that, it doesn't just pop up all of a sudden. In fact, it grows very slowly, doesn't it? And it survives winters and springs and summers and fall and winters and springs and summers and falls and grows, 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 grows and grows and grows and flourishes over time. Grass just grows up and withers and dies. Isn't that what it says over here in chapter 90, a little bit over here, a verse over? In the morning it flourishes and grows up. In the evening it is cut down and withers. I mean, I know grass goes dormant in wintertime and then grows back in the spring. But I'm talking about that which is freshly planted, how quickly it can grow up and how quickly it can die. The essence of all that I have said can be boiled down into the following statements. We in God's church, Christian people, take very seriously the pain and evil that exists in our world Why? Because God does. We believe that God is much more powerful and much greater than the very worst evil that we can imagine or that human beings can inflict upon one another. We believe that there are people out there who are suffering and who are persecuted, some of them like us, and they need to hear that evil and pain are not the last word. People are truly anxious and afraid, and they need to hear that God will give them strength to meet whatever tomorrow, next week, next month, or next year will bring. There are people there, people of our own number, who feel their lives have reached a dead end, and they need to know and to hear about living in hope and trusting in God. For after all, wasn't it God who said, "It is He that works in us both to will and to do of His good pleasure"? It's a principle that is brought to light in the story of Joseph. Learn it well. We may all need it sooner than we think.